This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's president is heading to Zimbabwe after visiting Kenya and Uganda. He says boosting ties with Africa is high on the agenda of Tehran's foreign policy. Russia says NATO's latest summit showed that the military alliance is returning to Cold War schemes and is unable to adapt to new geopolitical realities. And the UK's health sector is facing chaos as junior doctors in England staged the biggest walkout in the history of the country's state-funded National Health Service. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: President Ibrahim Raisi says expanding relations with African nations is high on the agenda of Iran's foreign policy as he's touring the continent. Raisi said Iran has developed good relations with African countries since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Ugandan counterpart in the capital, Kampala. The Iranian president called for boosting bilateral ties in different levels. Two sides also inked four cooperation documents. Raisi began his three-day tour by visiting Kenya in the capital, Nairobi. Iran's president and his Kenyan counterpart highlighted the importance of boosting bilateral cooperation.
We have historic cooperation with the African continent and Kenya, and believe that relations between the governments and people of Iran and Kenya can expand further. Our goal is to expand cooperation by tenfold.
I expressed our gratitude and commitment to expand and deepen these relations. President Raisi and I had the opportunity to engage views and share ideas about emerging opportunities to improve the balance of trade.
The Iranian and Kenyan presidents also signed a number of cooperation documents in various areas. President Raisi is heading to Zimbabwe after visiting Kenya and Uganda. This is the first visit to the African continent by an Iranian president in over a decade. Our correspondent Gisumi Shahmadi says the health industry is one of the main areas in which Tehran wants to cooperate with African nations.
We're going to Zimbabwe, one of the most important issues on the agenda, as far as I have been able to find out, is the issue of cooperation in health. And Iran is planning to expand its cooperation in this regard with African countries. This is one of the strong points of Iran. Iran has been able not just to produce pharmaceuticals at a price that is much more affordable for Africans than what other countries are offering them, but also Iran is prepared to set up clinics. And therefore, in Zimbabwe, what we are expecting to happen is to see cooperation agreements signed in the field of health, and also health tourism is something that Iran is looking to.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has criticized Western countries for their colonial pursuit despite claiming to be liberal democracies. Ayatollah Khamenei called those democracies a big lie. He said that Western states are opposed to freedom-seeking and any democracy which is independent of the global arrogance. He said that a clear example of such a policy is Ukraine, where civilians are being killed because Western arms manufacturers seek their benefits from the continuation of war. Elsewhere in his remarks, Iran's leader said the U.S. pursues evil acts as it confronts other nations in all fields. He said that today the West is vulnerable more than ever. Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that the steadfastness of the Iranian nation and the Islamic establishment against what he called the Western Front is in fact a cultural and global fight. Glenn Deason, a professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, says the Western hegemony is coming to an end as the U.S. sees its global power declining rapidly.
Well, I think that is a reference to 500 years of hegemony coming to an end. It can be seen in many aspects. Many would put this war as a key example that after 30 years of NATO expansion, which is a way for the U.S. to project its hegemony, we see this military balancing by the Russians, which is a challenge. But it's also, and I would argue, primarily in the economic sphere, which is why the U.S. is so hostile towards China, because under Chinese leadership, most of the world outside NATO is moving to other tech centers, new industries, new transportation corridors. They're de-dollarizing using their own currency, developing their own development banks, their own payment systems. So they see a whole economic system, effectively what underpins the U.S. hegemon. No dollar, there's no empire. So I think this is the weakest spot. And also this whole rules-based international order, which the U.S. has been promoting so heavily, to replace, to a large extent, international law, because it gives certain prerogatives to the U.S. and its allies. So, for example, it can exempt itself from international law. So it can interfere in domestic affairs of other countries. It can topple governments. You can invade. So all of this under the guise of liberal democracy. So you see a lot of the world now rejecting all of this. So there's a huge shift. But again, it's primarily economic, and you see it expressed politically. But of course, this war should also, to some extent, be understood as a rejection of this effort in Europe to develop U.S. hegemony at the expense of Russian security. So there's certainly a lot of truth to this. And I think this is also why the United States is quite anxious at the moment. Its security strategy is based on not accepting the emergence of any rivals which can challenge it. And it now sees its relative power in the world declining very rapidly. So there's a lot at stake in this conflict, which is why when tensions or relations are framed in this zero-sum, winner-takes-all format, we see that countries are willing to take much greater risks. And this is exactly what we're seeing now, as the world even risks a nuclear war.
Russia says the latest summit of NATO member states showed that the U.S.-led Western military alliance is returning to Cold War schemes. The Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement that the summit proved NATO's inability to adapt to the new geopolitical situation in the world. It added that the alliance is escalating political and military tensions as it continues to lower the threshold for the use of force. Russia also criticized NATO members' pledge to provide Ukraine with modern and long-range weapons, adding they only seek to prolong the conflict as long as possible. Moscow stressed that it will give a timely and appropriate response to all challenges and threats to its security and interests. The NATO summit in Lithuanian capital city Vilnius ended with the U.S. and its allies giving Ukraine new security assurances in its war with Russia. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in continuation of the coverage of the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's three-leg tour to Africa, we're now turning our attention to the third leg and third country of the Iranian president's visit, as his plane has just touched down in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. So the Iranian president is making his final stop of his three-nation Africa tour in Zimbabwe, as we've been covering since yesterday when he touched down in Kenya. The importance and the significance of this trip: it's the first time an Iranian president has visited Africa in over a decade. The Iranian president has stated specifically that expanding relations with African nations is high on the agenda of Iran's foreign policy as he is touring the continent. President Raisi said Iran has developed good relations with African countries since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Ugandan counterpart in the capital, Kampala. That was before he touched down in Zimbabwe, the third leg of his three-nation Africa tour. The Iranian president called for boosting bilateral ties at different levels. We also covered for you the signing of various documents of cooperation and MOUs with Kenyan officials yesterday, and there was a lot of focus on expanding trade and relations with Iran in the agricultural sector as well. The two sides After that, the Iranian president flew to Uganda, where there the two sides inked 4 cooperation documents. If I'm correct, I was covering it for you yesterday. 5 MOUs were signed in Nairobi. 4 were signed in Kampala. Rais Uganda's 3-day tour by visiting Kenya, that was leg 1. There, Iran's president and his Kenyan counterpart highlighted the importance of boosting bilateral cooperation as well. Now the Iranian president is in Zimbabwe as his plane is touched down in the capital, Harare. It's the first visit to the continent by an Iranian president in over a decade, 11 years to be precise. And of course, we're seeing the warm welcome that the Iranian president is receiving by officials and people alike in Zimbabwe as his plane has just touched down in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. The Iranian president also described his trip as a turning point in bilateral relations with the African countries, noting that it can create a good market for Iranian products in the country which he was in on his first stop, Kenya, and also for East Africa as well. Following his trip to Kenya and the events that took place in Nairobi, the Iranian president touched down in Uganda, where also there similar proceedings took place as MOUs were signed, pledges were made to increase trade and bilateral cooperation and economic relations between the countries of Iran and Uganda. There, the two sides also inked 4 cooperation documents and MOUs. And now it's leg 3 of the Iranian president's 3-nation tour of African countries as he's landed in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. We will be expecting to see similar events and proceedings taking place there as well. There will be a meeting with high-ranking officials and major players in the economy, in the economic sector. Then we'll most likely see signing of various documents of cooperation and memorandums of understanding, and then a press conference will be held to sum up the trip and the talks and negotiations and the outcome of the visit of the Iranian president to Zimbabwe as he wraps up his 3-nation African tour. The Iranian president has expressed his willingness to increase that capacity and potential tenfold as he's visiting three sub-Saharan African nations. We are going to keep you posted, of course, on all the details of the last leg of the Iranian president's tour of Africa. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited Lithuania this week to take part in the NATO summit in Seoul. President Yoon's moves to strengthen the country's ties with NATO are drawing criticism. Critics argue that South Korea should maintain more independence in its foreign policy, which has become too closely tied to the U.S. Russia has warned Western countries against supplying F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, saying that Moscow will regard such a move as a nuclear threat. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow cannot ignore the ability of these aircraft to carry nuclear weapons. Modern warplanes have been at the forefront of Kiev's demands as part of the military aid from its Western allies, but Washington has not yet given the go-ahead for any country to supply Ukraine with F-16s. Meanwhile, a coalition of 11 nations will start training Ukrainian pilots on using the U.S.-made aircraft at a center to be set up in Romania in August. Russia has repeatedly said that providing more arms to Kiev will only prolong the war in Ukraine. And the UK's health sector is facing chaos as junior doctors in England staged the biggest walkout in the history of the country's state-funded National Health Service. The unprecedented 5-day walkout starting from Thursday is a dramatic escalation of dispute between doctors and the government over pay and working conditions. Junior doctors had walked out before, but the latest industrial action is prompting fears for patient safety as the UK is already reeling from a vast pandemic backlog. Senior hospital doctors will also begin a 48-hour strike on July the 20th, with radiographers following suit on July 25th. Nurses, ambulance staff, and other medical staff have all joined picket lines in recent months. The country has been witnessing back-to-back strikes in a wide range of public and private sectors. Workers demand higher wages to cope with the cost of living crisis amid skyrocketing inflation. It's been 17 years since Israel launched a full-scale war against Lebanon. The impacts of the Israeli act of aggression are still being discussed and analyzed. Mariam Sada reports from Lebanon.
17 years have passed since Israel launched its biggest full-scale war against Lebanon, apart from the 1982 invasion. The Israeli Air Force bombarded the infrastructure of Lebanon, threw cluster munitions in most of southern Lebanon, and killed over 1,200 people. The town of Bint Ishbael witnessed some of the most fierce fighting during the 2006 war. This market was turned to rubble, yet that was a cost the people of Lebanon were ready to pay if it meant that Israel would be deterred from launching another act of aggression. The fighting here turned to hand-to-hand combat at times, and the Israelis were still incapable of dislodging Hezbollah, while resistance rockets increased. Strategy experts believe that before 2006, Hezbollah's main goal was a strategy of defense. Yet the fighting capabilities of the resistance has reached an extent where launching a preemptive war against the Israelis is plausible. Israel's internal investigations into the July war proved that it was a failed mission for the regime. Yet Hezbollah's military presence remains intact and its popular support stronger than ever before. The 2006 July war gave birth to a new equilibrium in the conflict between Lebanon and Israel, and it proved that Hezbollah was not to be taken lightly. Israel's worst fear now is that any wrong move could fight Hezbollah in the Galilee region. Mariam Saleh, Maruna Ras, South Lebanon.
That's a wrap for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Memorable Triumph of Islam. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, friends, and how about listening to an interesting program on an event of the early days of Islam that stands out as a perennial beacon of light for all those seeking truth, determined to correct their beliefs and eager to perfect their faith by avoiding superstitions and irrational modes of thought. For your information, today is the 24th of the Islamic month of Dhul-Hajjah, the anniversary of the day of Mubahale that saw a dynamic dialogue of the Christians of Arabia with the Prophet of Islam and his blessed household, the Ahlul Bayt, on the nature of Jesus, peace upon him, which removed so many misconceptions. This unique event placed into permanent spotlight the peerless personalities of the fabulous five whom God Almighty has exalted above all his creatures. That is Prophet Muhammad, his impeccable daughter Hazrat Fatima Zahra, his immaculate son-in-law Imam Ali, and his infallible grandsons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them. Please stay with us for details in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
In 8 AH, the peaceful surrender of Mecca, the bastion of polytheism, to the prophet who magnanimously granted general amnesty to his avowed enemies without seeking the least vengeance for the horrible crimes they had committed against him, including the brutal killing of his beloved uncle Hamza, proved a catalyst in the spread of Islam throughout Arabia. Several pagan Arab tribes, as well as Jews and Christians, approached him to discuss the dynamics of faith, and many of them embraced the truth of Islam. The Prophet, as commanded by God, wrote letters and sent emissaries to the leaders of various religions and the political rulers of his time, including the Roman Emperor Heraclius and Iran's Sassanid Emperor Khosrow Parviz, inviting them to the divine truth of Islam. Among the recipients of the Prophet's letters was the Archbishop of the Christian land of Najran, situated between Yemen and Hejaz. On receiving the letter, the Archbishop convened a council and consulted with its members on this matter. One of the Christian prelates said, "Remember, reports have come down to us from our forefathers of God Almighty's raising of a great prophet from among the offspring of Prophet Abraham's firstborn son, Ishmael. So let us send a delegation to Medina to find out what are the teachings of Islamic and whether this person is the awaited prophet whose coming Jesus has prophesied." Thus, a high-level Christian delegation of Najran arrived in Medina, and the Prophet of Islam made arrangements for their stay, even providing a part of the principal mosque for holding their own rituals and forms of worship. At first sight, the Christian priests, who were adorned in all their finery, including silken robes and gold-plated headgears and staffs, were struck by the simplicity of the attire of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. For 3 days, a lively debate went on, with the Prophet of Islam presenting to them the most logical and rational proofs of the glory of the one and only creator of the universe, who cannot have human traits to be in need of sons or children. He explained in the most convincing manner the mission of Prophet Jesus, how he used to cure lepers and the blind, and how, by the commandment of God, he performed other miracles, including fashioning of a bird out of clay and then breathing life into it. Christian priests, however, remained stubborn. They stuck to the weird concept of Trinity or three Godheads, but were unable to provide any reasonable proofs. They said, "If Jesus is the servant and creature of God, as you say, who is his father? A created human being should have a father." In response, the Prophet of Islam recited ayahs 59 and 60 of Surah Al-Imran of the Noble Quran, which read, "Indeed, the case of Jesus with God is like the case of Adam. He created him from dust, then said to him, 'Be,' and he was. This is the truth from your Lord, so do not be among the doubters." The Prophet explained that Adam, the father of mankind, was created from clay without any parents by the omnipotent Lord. So, if lack of father is a sign of divinity, then Adam should be considered more superior and more meritorious than Jesus, who after all had a mother. The Christian priests were dumbstruck, but refused to accept the logical remarks of the Prophet of Islam and insisted on their claims without any justified reason by casting doubts on the righteousness and truthfulness of the divine religion of Islam. At this point, Archangel Gabriel descended with more revelations from God. The Prophet recited to the Christians the fresh commandment from the ethereal heavens in the form of Ayah 61 of Surah Al Imran. Should anyone argue with you concerning him after the knowledge that has come to you, say, "Come, let us call our sons and your sons, our women and your women, our souls and your souls, then let us invoke and call down Allah's curse upon the liars." It was a novel challenge of invoking the curse or malediction of God Almighty on the liars. The Christian priests of Najran accepted it on the assumption that they were on the right path and that God would answer their prayers. That night, the two sides prepared for a showdown the next morning to invoke divine curse. The Christians threw elaborate rituals to their Trinity and the Prophet with a simple prayer of thanksgiving to the omnipresent Lord. The Prophet of Islam covered himself with a cloak and was joined in it by his two little grandsons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, his daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, and his son-in-law, Imam Ali, peace upon them all. He supplicated, "O Lord, these are my Ahlul Bayt, my dearest and nearest ones. Grant them the certificate of purity." When Umme Salame, a wife of the Prophet, asked permission to join them, she was politely refused, saying that although she is on the right path, the Ahlul Bayt are an exclusive group, exalted by God over the rest of humanity. At this moment, Archangel Gabriel descended, giving tidings to the Prophet that God Almighty has created everything in the heavens and the earth for the sake of this blessed group. He conveyed the divine revelation in the form of verse 33 of Surah Rum of the Noble Quran, which reads, "Indeed, Allah desires to ward off all impurity from you, Ahlul Bayt, and keep you thoroughly pure." At dawn, on the 24th of the day of Dhul-Hajjah, when the Christian priest assembled at the appointed place outside the city of Medina with their flock, they were amazed to see the Prophet entering the field in a calm and composed manner, without any of his companions and without any of the wives that he had married in middle age as social necessities. He was accompanied only by his immediate family members, that is, daughter Hazrat Fatima Zahra, her husband Imam Ali, and the couple's two young sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them all. The awestruck Christians of Najran realized the truth. They were beholding such enlightened visages that would instantly bring down the wrath of God if this blessed group of five were to raise their hands to heaven. The Christians wisely withdrew the challenge and made peace, thereby proving to posterity the folly of opposing the Ahlul Bayt. The day of Mubahale thus left a lasting impression on the minds of mankind of the inseparable link between the Prophet's progeny and the Book of God. The Archbishop of Najran turned to his followers and said, "I see such enlightened faces that if they were to beseech God, even mountains would move from their places. Therefore, it is sheer suicide to enter into a contest of malediction with this enlightened group. We might all be wiped out." The Christian delegation decided to enter into a compromise, which the Prophet of Islam accepted, and a peace accord was signed that allowed those of the people of Najran who were not yet ready to accept Islam to practice their own beliefs under protection of the Islamic ruling system, which would protect their lives and belongings in lieu of payment for an annual tax. Thus, this day is indeed a glorious event in not just the history of Islam that saw triumph in a peaceful parley, but is also manifestation of the status of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, or immediate family, for whom love, affection, respect, obedience, and leadership is obligatory for all Muslims. The anniversary of the Day of Mubahale is also an opportunity for present-day Christians to contemplate on rational facts, instead of blindly adhering to the weird and irrational concept of Trinity, coined by the Hellenized Jew, Paul, which is surely displeasing to Jesus, peace upon him.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
NATO leaders say that they are prepared for Ukraine to ultimately join the military alliance. Now, a draft of the summit communique pledges to extend an invitation to Ukraine to join the alliance when allies agree and conditions are met. But a problem is that allies do not agree. Now, Ukrainian President Zelensky immediately hit out at the 31-member alliance for negotiating the text without Kiev at the table. Now, he complained that it seems, in his words, there is no readiness neither to invite Ukraine to NATO nor to make it a member of the alliance. Now, I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Stay with us for a discussion of Ukraine's NATO membership bid and the division among NATO members over the issue. Let's first see who's joining us in today's edition of The Spotlight. We'll have Christoph Horstel, author and politician from Berlin. And also from Walnut Tree in California, Rick Sterling, investigative journalist, is joining us. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, let me begin with Christoph. My question for you is, as you just heard me in the intro that NATO is saying that Ukraine's future lies in the military alliance, but there is no time frame, no guarantees either for Ukraine's accession. Now, doesn't this indicate divisions among NATO's 31 members over given a date for a straightforward invitation for Ukraine to join? You know, Kiev has been pushing for a swift entry with security guarantees since even before the war with Russia.
Yeah, of course there are divisions. Of course there's pressure within NATO. It sounds strange that President Erdogan of Turkey has suddenly declared that he's in favor of Kiev's membership within NATO, but still issues contradictive statements on the NATO membership of Sweden. So what we have here is a very interesting situation in where the old and new NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg says that Erdogan has told him that he is ready to accept Sweden as a NATO member. But we miss President Erdogan's own statement. And there are complicated issues about, you know, the formal conduct of this standpoint in the Turkish parliament. And there are forerunners saying that this is not sure that Turkey really supports Kiev, Ukraine, within NATO, because the parliament can say no. So these are very interesting situations right now. Certainly NATO is strongly divided, and the US has a very strange policy. They insist that the NATO members push for Ukraine's membership and not the US, not Washington, whereas everybody knows that Washington is in favor of that, whereas in our media it is said that Washington is against it. So we have a very, very interesting situation in NATO. This is not what I call, in fact, a strong alliance. This is a strongly divided alliance.
Okay, now let me turn to Rick. Rick, you know, the issue of how to acknowledge Ukraine's membership ambitions while it's fighting Russia is indicative of divide within NATO, isn't it? Weeks of intense negotiations have been held, and the U.S. and Germany are still wary of implying that Kiev's membership is inevitable without conditions attached. Let's have your assessment.
Yeah. Well, in the meeting here, NATO has dropped one formal requirement, which was the completing the membership application plan. But they've raised another vague and ambiguous condition, which is for conditions to be met. And I think significantly, the Secretary General of NATO said in the question and answer that unless Ukraine wins the war, there's no question of membership. And this goes along with the statements of Biden that it's not at all viable for Ukraine to join NATO while it's at war, because that would mean the U.S. and the other NATO countries would be at war. So I think they're giving they're trying to hold out the hope for Ukraine to be admitted to NATO in the future, but they realize that would be suicidal at the present time.
Okay. Now, Christoph, President Zelensky has reacted online. And he said, quoting him, it was unprecedented and absurd when a time frame is not set, neither for the invitation nor for Ukraine's membership. And he also attacked NATO's what he called vague conditions for inviting Kiev. You know, NATO agreed in 2008 that Ukraine will become a member, but provided no timeline or accession process. So what's the catch?
So we have, in fact, a double blackmail situation here. Very clearly, April last year, Zelensky was forced to stop any peace initiative already signed by his people with Russia. Mm-hmm. And now we have the situation where President Zelensky says, okay, yes or no, what do you want? If you, in fact, he says it indirectly, he doesn't say it directly, if you want us to continue to bleed for you, you better make us a member. And what is on the other side is that Zelensky simply might, you know, retire and ask another power to give him a home and an opportunity to run away from his job. Everybody knows that these things are on the table with the NATO, not openly, but secretly. So President Zelensky is playing a very, very dangerous double game. Behind the scenes, he has ventured to some of the traveling, diplomats, that it is necessary that he needs a lot of money should he leave his job, because as he may have said, purportedly has said, that he has to pay his generals. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows that. Everybody knows that his position is crazy. Everybody knows that this war cannot be won by Kiev. Everybody knows that the fight is completely in vain. Everybody knows that if that continues, and if there's more provocation like coming from President Macron right now offering a further reach of drones and things like that, that Russia, if these drones truly reach Russian territory, mm-hmm. that they are ready to, you know, forward so far that these drones can no longer reach Russian territory. That is the threat from Moscow. And sooner or later, that will come true, certainly, if these drones reach. So what do we have here? We have, in fact, a very dangerous stalemate with no exit, because Russia is the only winner without or with the stalemate. And that is something in a situation where, of course, we must understand that President Zelensky has to make his choices. And now he has given to NATO his idea that he thinks this is absurd. And we are very curious how long this Mr. Zelensky is ready and willing and able to keep up his absurd position.
Okay. Now, Rick, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says that NATO is also discussing, apart from membership, weapon supplies to Kiev. That's, you know, trying to push forward what is so-called counteroffensive against Russia. Russian spokesman also told reporters any move to speed up Ukraine's admission into NATO would be, quote, potentially very dangerous for European security. Now, do you see eye to eye? And if so, what type of danger is he alluding to?
Well, I'm not sure what type of suggesting that the Ukraine would be brought directly into NATO. I think perhaps he's alluding to that, and which would precipitate exactly the event that both Stoltenberg and Biden have spoken of, which is that if Ukraine was admitted to NATO, then NATO would be at war directly with Russia, and that would basically mean World War III. In the 17-page communique, which has been produced following today's NATO summit, there's a lot of platitudes, but there's also some statements that are significant, which is that NATO will never recognize any territory that has been admitted to the Russian Federation, and specifically Crimea. Of course, Crimea had a referendum in 2014, mm-hmm. and 97% of the population, with 83% turnout, said that they wanted to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. So, right. And this is the general situation that some 30% of the Ukrainian population identify as coming from Russian culture. Russian is their first language. So behind all the talk about democracy, there's an absolute absence of democracy. And that's also significant because Kiev has imprisoned one of the major opposition candidates. They've made illegal the Russian Orthodox Church. So there's a total absence of any pretense of democracy. So yeah, on those grounds as well, it's completely hypocritical for NATO to suggest that Ukraine should be part of their alliance.
Mm-hmm. Now, Christoph, in the middle of this membership bid at NATO, the West is offering arms to Ukraine, and it's in full swing. Larger and larger pledges are made. Even France, that's grappling with a plethora of issues and protests on the home turf, you know, says that it would send long-range Scalp cruise missiles to Ukraine, and the missiles are the same as Storm Shadow that UK already provided, you know. And the UK is also another European country, you know, facing strike action, you know, over a cost of living crisis and all that. So I want to ask you, what is it that makes these countries neglect their own issues at home and prioritize the issues of Ukraine over those of their own people?
you see that Germany is not a sovereign country is something which is sometimes openly issued by German higher politicians, but in fact it's all of Europe which has to follow Washington's wishes. And these governments obviously are more afraid of Washington than of their own voters and populations. And that is the situation that makes them go this belligerent way and aggressively furnishing a country which cannot, by definition, so to say, withstand Russia's troops with weapons which will only serve to kill more people, that's all. And I'm talking about Ukrainians and Russians alike. They are dying because of NATO weapons, all of them in vain, not for nothing, but completely in vain. It's a vain, useless, senseless, idiotic war, only made up by corrupt forces in Washington. And that is a very, very tragic story that this continues so far. And that is behind all this NATO blah, blah, and all these offers and all these weapons is this, in fact, grotesque dying of Ukrainian people for zero result for Ukraine.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Rick, why should such countries that are already grappling with their own issues, they are facing protests, strike action on top of the strike action, protests over protests, but Ukraine comes first to them?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wonder why more Americans and more Europeans are not asking it and out in the streets. I know that there are some protests. We've had some protests. No more weapons to Ukraine being the signature motto of one of the actions, but there should be much more. And the situation, I mean, behind the scenes of the NATO summit, there has to be a growing realization that the war is lost, as the other guest was saying, that the so-called counteroffensive was a complete failure. And the recent announcement that the U.S. is going to start sending cluster munitions,
exactly,
that's another dividing point. And even the foreign minister of Germany has come out against that, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The explanation from Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor of the U.S., was that they've run out of regular munitions. That they and they need the cluster munitions as they referred to it as a bridge or stopgap until they can produce more regular munitions. So that's how desperate the situation is, and that's how badly the war is going from their standpoint.
Right. Christoph, this cluster munition is actually my next question, and Rick mentioned it. You know, all NATO allies are stressing that they have this primary objective that they're pushing is to make sure that Ukraine has what is necessary to continue to fight with Russia. And the U.S. has gone even as far as trying to provide Ukraine with controversial cluster bombs. You know what cluster bombs mean. And the U.S. has a long record of using cluster bombs. You know, 120-plus countries oppose this, and so do some Western allies of Washington. Your take on that?
First of all, that shows that our ammunition reserves have been, you know, plundered, in fact, and they are empty. And it is said by our military expert that 6 to 12 hours Germany army would be able to withstand if there's an attack. and after that we run out of ammunition. So this is true. But of course, this is no excuse, viable and useful in any way, that you provide another country in a war situation with cluster bombs. Cluster bombs are forbidden, and it is very clear that the U.S. is breaking again a law, yeah, and a rule, and something which has been agreed, rightly say, 120 countries. Kiev signed, yeah. In former times, of course. So this is a perverted situation that shows in a very bright light the extent of criminal policies to which Washington is ready to go in order to make sure that the dying of Ukrainians continues. Mm-hmm. And that's so far a terrible, in fact, a terrible fact that we face with this NATO summit, that all of NATO is unable to speak out in favor of rules of law. We call ourselves the rules-based West, and we spit on any rule, we spit on any law, we spit on any contract if we have to, and continue our dirty policies. So in fact, this is a shame summit of NATO there in Vilnius, and that they need so much security for these politicians, that seems natural.
Exactly. Now, Rick, all NATO member states agree that Ukraine cannot join the alliance while the war is going on. That's what also President Biden said. Now, it's because they say that this would trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense clause and bring all members into conflict. You know, but the thing is this really why they're saying this? Because, you know, they are involved in the war, given all the military and logistical support for Kyiv.
They are involved in the war, but it's the Ukrainians who are doing the dying. So from the United States perspective, and of course the NATO is completely dominated by the United States, this is okay. In fact, they can even see, you can even see that there's an economic advantage to the United States, because all of that, what a big portion, at least, of the military hardware that's going to Ukraine is manufactured in the United States. So the military-industrial complex, their stocks have been rising. They're doing fine. They're getting very hefty contracts to produce more and more munitions and weapons. And many of the European states that have been providing weapons to Ukraine, they're coming to the United States to supply them. There's one area where the United States is an industrial leader. One of the few areas that are left is in the military hardware side of things. So that's the sad thing, and I completely agree with the other guest here that this is tragic and this is totally unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And Ukrainians are dying, and it's people like Lindsey Graham, the senator from the Republican Party in Washington, longtime senator, who's even said explicitly, this is kind of an ideal situation. Ukrainians are helping us destabilize and weaken Russia. So that's the tragic and sad thing about this. The Ukrainians are tools in this proxy war, which is unnecessary and should be ended immediately.
Okay, and Christoph, the G7, advanced Western economies are also separately preparing to announce a multilateral security arrangement for Ukraine on Wednesday, and this is following the NATO summit. And that would mean bilateral pledges, which are set to include military and financial support packages for Kyiv to help it fight Russia for, quote, as long as it takes. How much longer would it go on, in your opinion?
First of all, it goes as long as the peoples in the West support it. So if they storm the White House and if they depose the illegal U.S. government, that's finished. And there's another point. If we do that in Germany, that would be even enough to finish it, because without making sure that Germany is a victim of this war in Ukraine, Washington would not be ready to continue. So this is a very interesting question. I'm right now in an election campaign in Germany, and we see the situation very, very clearly. Unless, you know, peace promotion is backed by enough people, war will win. and that is a rule worldwide.
Okay, and I got one last question for both of you. You have each 1 minute. Rick, what's the prospect of security in Europe, you know, given the goings-on in that part of the world, and how would that impact security worldwide?
Well, the prospects are not good at the current moment because the United States and their so-called partners in NATO keep going up the escalation ladder. They said they wouldn't send long-range missiles, then they overturned that. Then they indicated they wouldn't do depleted munitions, then they did that. They said they wouldn't do, there wasn't cluster bombs and so on and so forth. The attack on the Nord Stream pipeline, which was clearly carried out by the U.S. and or allies, and the blowing up of the dam, the Kukovo Dam, the threats against the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. Where's the escalation going to stop? So I totally agree that we need an outpouring of opposition to the war. It's hurting people worldwide and endangering, you know, the entire world.
Okay. Christoph, you have 1 minute.
Yeah. We have a very, very bad perspective. In fact, our governments fight against their own people. They keep their opposition divided, espionaged upon. They keep them under pressure, under illegal pressure. So the whole judicial apparatus is being misused to oppress the opposition in Western countries, in Germany, of course, as well. Our little party, what happens to us is crazy. So we have a situation where the European people have no means left to liberate themselves. All these rulers are externally and internally going forward illegally, and that is a very, very bad situation. And I don't see any close positive viewpoint on this, and I'm very much fearing escalation.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Christoph Forstall in Berlin, Germany. Rick Sterling in Walnut Creek, California. And thank you. See you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamate began at a very young age, about 8.
السلام عليك يا أبا جعفر محمد بن علي البر التقي.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Peace and blessings upon him. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam economized when it came to spending upon himself. He lived a rather ascetic, simple lifestyle. But His Eminence Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spent a great abundant amount of wealth on the poor and the needy people amongst the Muslims. And it is precisely because of this unequaled and unparalleled generosity that Imam al-Jawad has been called and titled al-Jawad, the Generous. This surname was the most particular